Well, we'll get started. Welcome, everyone, to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. And we want to just let everybody know that we are Zooming from Theosophy Hall, as well as we are having in-person meetings as well. And the doors open at 10:30. And for those of you that do come into Theosophy Hall, we want to just thank you for joining us and maintaining a fragrance-free zone for the benefit of those who have sensitivities. And we, during the pandemic, we have been very happy to have this technology of Zoom in order to stay connected. We have also been grateful that because of Zoom, we have been able to get participants from around the country, Canada.
The islands, whatever.
Yeah, the islands. And just very, very grateful that we've been able to stay connected with so many folks of like-minded. And we just want to let everybody know that the ULT Declaration maintains anonymity, so we offer no crosstalk or side issues or personal anecdotes, and participants speak directly to the chairperson when called on. We ask that if you are not speaking, to please keep your microphone on mute. And if you do have to get up and walk around or do anything, we ask that you stop your video. These traditions are designed to welcome all to the study of the philosophy without having any kind of distractions of any social differentiation or personal attributes. So we ask that we can all work together to maintain these ideas. So we will now turn the meeting over to another student.
We gather on this Sunday morning as a United Lodge of Theosophists. And being that, we declare that the policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work, that end, is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true Theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all.
Now, in order for this lodge to accomplish these incredible goals, we do have 3 meetings a week. And as of today, and as today, we, as was said earlier, we have an in-person as well as Zoom meeting, and it's only on Sundays that we do this. The doors open at 10:30. The meeting starts at 11 and goes until 12. And for this month, we have been looking at the keys of virtue, which can be found in the Voice of the Silence. Today's meeting will be the keys of mental devotion and self-sacrifice. Next week, we start a new umbrella topic, and that is the mysterious mind. And the first meeting on the 6th will be the spectrum of genius. We also still are in the Ocean of Theosophy on Wednesdays from 7:30 until 8:45. And we will be finishing up karma. And on Fridays, we are having a roundtable, and we are going to start with a new book. It's called The Heart Doctrine, and tomorrow you will be receiving the reading for Friday. If you want to get that book, it is, we will be sending it out. You would be able to buy it at theosophycompany.org. But it is not available on Phoenix, the Phoenix website. So we think those are all our announcements, and we will be starting. Oh, we did forget. The United Lodge of Theosophists is financially sustained entirely by voluntary contributions. Its activities depend similarly on voluntary offerings in time and work. All are invited to participate, but no obligation is imposed or implied. So we will start the meeting now with the first talk on mental devotion.
We begin where we are. And where are we? Why are we studying these ideas? What is our motive? And that always must be examined. Because on this path, if this is what you are looking for, it begins with love. If one does not love, have compassion and charity, this is how we grow. And dana is really the first paramita. But through harmony, we gain moral strength. And by patience, we learn to use it. Until we understand that we can stand detached or indifferent to the opposites of nature, to like and dislike. And through this discovery and this overcoming of the lower nature, one is filled with energy. And that energy can be used now for higher purposes if the lower is being under control. And with this energy, we can enter into ceaseless meditation. And then ultimately attain full wisdom and be able to be a helper, a worker for mankind, to aid in the suffering of humanity. These paramitas are a path. Dhyana is that path of, we would say, mindfulness. And that path of devotion. That through meditation, through mindfulness, that's all meditation is mindfulness. We are told that we really have a life that is a meditation, a life's meditation, whether it be in the field of whatever our work is. It has been our life meditation. But have we considered the life meditation of our higher nature, of our nature in which we can bring forth the goodness of man? You know, the Buddhist have outlined a path of these dhyanas, this ceaseless contemplation, this mindfulness and devotion. And they state that moral practice, right speech, and right action, and right livelihood are shila qualities, are moral in their true essence. That right effort, right awareness, right concentration are dhyana. Right knowledge, right view, and right aspiration are prajna. It seems that the shila quality and dhyana, both which symbolize our, the moral quality of life. The moral and meditation go hand in hand. We are told that we should meditate for a half hour a day. Just a half hour. And by that is meant that one begins to recalibrate one's reality. When we begin to recalibrate our reality, we go from the mundane to really the transcendental. We begin to expand our mind, because we are identifying with that. We come to this study and we crave to hear, teach us how to meditate. What is meditation? We hear so much about it. Well, we are left to our own devices to do as we see fit. But Buddhism has many hints of how to develop calmness and concentration so that one can develop that dhyanic state, that ceaseless contemplation. You know, our whole life is a meditation. So we all studied, we all worked, we've all achieved. But that's on the material plane. That's mundane. What about that spiritual side of us that we are trying to recognize, and we're trying to see it as part of who we are, this witness to this constant change around us? There is a system of thought that by concentration and the use of will, we meditate. We look back through our references and we wanted to see if we could find an aid for us to understand meditation or how we can do it. And it's laid out in practical terms. And there's terms that are Sanskrit, like dharana, it means like selecting a thing, a spot, or an idea to fix the mind on. Then dhyana, the next step, is contemplation of it. The third is samadhi, or is meditating on it. Now, this is just one act, not three. Select it, hold on to it, meditate on it. This gives firmness of mind. So, you know, that we try to cultivate mindfulness in our everyday activities. We are told in the Gita that it's what comes to us we need to accept and not react, but to act. That everything is just and fair. You know, that to understand that, you know, there is a purpose for meditation. It's to transform an ordinary person into a more calm, concerned, and compassionate person. And this is done by focus, by concentration. You know, when we think of something, we are gathering energies about us. The mind is a mass of energies. And that if we're able to focus them, there is great strength, great power. So our whole day should be an exercise in concentration. But we drain our energy away by idle conversation, mental rambling, reliving the past, being anxious about things that have not yet happened. We begin to understand that our moments must be spent usefully. So through meditation, we enter into samadhi. What is that? A place of peace, of tranquility. But there is not only one place, there are many. That as the mind acquires more and more concentration, these energies or these concentrations of force become stronger. And then more knowledge is revealed. We become more porous to the dictates of the soul. But these dhyanis, these meditations are all focused on who we are, what we are, where we are, and being ever mindful of the moment that we are in. Because the moment is the only reality. And once one begins to contemplate reality, one moves from the mundane to the transcendental. One begins to expand one's reality. It's said that when we live in this world, performing our worldly duties, but act for and as the self of all creatures, we are engaged in ceaseless contemplation. Being inwardly detached from the world of Maya. Concentration, will, and meditation. These are ideas that we should dwell upon. We should think about. We should ponder. We should contemplate. Our entire day, we should have ideas and words that pop into our head that relate to this philosophy or these ideas. Always reminding ourselves that we are not this form. We are more than that. We are thinking beings. And our connection is through the mind. We think that the admonition of HPV is think. Think. If we can get our friends and neighbors to think, we have accomplished much. So we'll move to prajna.
Because prajna is the seventh and last virtue, we did want to just read something from a series of articles called The Divine Virtues. And it's a correlation, it speaks of a correlation between the seven. The interrelation between the seven paramitas has to be understood. If we put them in a circle, like the seven globes of the planetary chain, we shall find that the first and the seventh, dana and prajna, are on one plane and make a pair. The second and sixth, shila and dhyana, are on the next plane and make another pair. The third and fifth, Kashanti and Virya come next and make a third pair. Remains the middle paramita, Virga, desirelessness or dispassion, which constitutes for us the starting point. So as was said, it is necessary that we do concentrate on the paramitas in order for growth. So we are told that this paramita, prajna, is an amalgamation of the preceding six. By successfully perfecting the previous virtues, the soul has gained the power or capacity that gives rise to perception. It clears out our faulty perception and gives us the capacity and the ability of making and understanding true perceptions. And prajna takes us to the highest level, that state of full perception, to see the real truth as it is, to see things as they are and not as they seem. In this higher level of evolution, at our perception is not affected by our experiences, prejudices, or preconceived ideas as they are now. And we know that just by speaking with others, reading the newspaper, listening to the news, we know that our perceptions can be skewed. And we may not understand or even be aware that they are erroneous thoughts. So our goal in view is to accomplish right perception through compassionate wisdom of the mind and the heart. The voice of the silence says that prajna is the key to which makes of man a god, creating him a bodhisattva, son of the dhyanis. But what is meant by a bodhisattva? At this stage of evolution, what part of our nature has been developed? Our mind is being controlled by our lower nature combined with kama, which are passions and desires. So in order for us to move along this path, we have to be able to raise up that lower mind and transmute it into the higher. And when this occurs, then mind is then joined and bonded with buddhi, and that's the spiritual soul. And it doesn't mean that the lower tendencies are being, it's not that they're gone. It's just that they are under the control of the bodhisattva. And again, the voice of the silence says that a bodhisattva is less than a perfect Buddha, but his self-sacrifice has placed this bodhisattva higher in reverence than a Buddha. At this point, the soul needs but one more incarnation to enter into nirvana. But will this bodhisattva go into nirvana, or will he stay back to help his younger brothers? His awareness of the suffering of mankind has a profound effect on him, increasing his self-consciousness, his reason, and his knowledge. His true compassion must overshadow and dominate any lower characteristics. And we did want to read a section from a book called The Dream of Ravon, and it's on page 44. Sattvika, or self-consciousness of truth or goodness, and what is being mentioned here are the three gunas, characteristics of all beings. And it's sattva, rajas, and tamas. Sattvika, or self-consciousness of truth or goodness, the rasasha, or self-consciousness of passion, and the tamasa, or self-consciousness of darkness. So sattva is the most spiritual, and the other two less so. We're looking at passion and of darkness. So what is needed to be done then is we have to choose which one of these gunas are the ones that we will choose to focus on and pattern our life after. And we have to choose in order to benefit others. So the talk today has to do with self-sacrifice. The Bodhisattva sees his past lives and he determines that indeed it was, he sees his own sufferings and he is aware that those sufferings were warranted and that he can learn from them, that they are educational. And by not focusing on his past lives, he is able to be aware of the sufferings of his younger brothers and sisters. And he knows he needs to attend to them rather than entering nirvana or bliss. He has to use everything that he has learned in order to help others and not himself. This is the self-sacrifice, is that he is sacrificing himself for the good of all. So he is inviting the suffering on himself by shielding others. He is renouncing nirvana, and this is what he realizes that he has to do. This suffering then has been chosen. It has not been forced on him. He is doing it of his own free will. He has chosen his choice. He has chosen the sattvic path. He has chosen this idea of self-sacrifice. He is sacrificing his bliss, and he is doing it to help others. So then what can we learn from this then, from the self-sacrifice that is being performed by the Bodhisattva? We can realize that this is a path that we can attain the end in view. The Paramitas have taught us this, that this is the way to perfection, to compassion or dana, and that this is by doing for others. It is the self-sacrifice to the all, to choose not for ourselves, but for others. And this theosophical literature, especially the Voice of the Silence and the Bhagavad Gita, discuss this at length. So study the Paramitas and practice them. And to end, we just have one more quote. And this again is from Prajna from the Divine Virtues. On the Paramita path, the practitioner should give up the habit of one, fanciful thinking, 2, loose talk, and 3, selfish acts, and adopt such aesthetic rules as are conducive to the concentration of mind and purity in speech. The aspirant to occultism must not misuse the powers of thought and speech and strive to rise above the ordinary ways of the world. The Paramita path may be well called the preparatory class for the school of occultism, in which the student is getting his mental luggage ready. So we will now take your questions or comments.
Before we take a question, we think it's appropriate to read a quote from The Voice of the Silence about our subject this morning. The Dhyana Gate is like an alabaster vase, white and transparent. Within, there burns a steady golden fire, the flame of prajna that radiates from Atma. Thou art that vase.
So we have a question here at Theosophy Hall.
So, giving up that polite conversation, which it seems like we always have to fill a vacuum, like we can't have silence, it seems, in society. How do we give up that? In a sense, it's good to connect with somebody, but on the other hand, if it's just like mindless chit chat, how do we give that up? How do we sacrifice that and yet still be present and personal to those that were around?
So the question has to do with the polite chit chat. Do we really have to give that up? And if it's polite and we're getting to know someone, then why should we have to give up polite chit chat?
We believe it's said that we need to be friendly, and that unnecessary conversation is unnecessary, but we need to be friendly. So how do we do that? So that's why we're in control.
And we think too that in regards to that comment, that if we're at a party, we want to get to know someone, so maybe some of this polite chit chat has to do with getting to know the person. So we would think that we have to make choices as to what we're going to talk about, find out where that other person is, but we don't want to get too personal, especially if it's the first time we're meeting someone. SL?
Well, certainly trying to understand a human being, their family, their occupation, their aspirations, what they value, that's not chit-chat. It's a sincere endeavor to try to understand another human being, where they're coming from and what their needs might be. What we might want to definitely give up, though, is the tendency in social discourse to condemn another, or to spread gossip or rumors, to poison, so a sense, the speech and the thought and the atmosphere with those negative qualities. So we're selective in what we're giving up. Just like the passions and desires, we need desire, we need the energy of desire, but we certainly want to give up those worldly passions and desires that are purely selfish and are obstacles.
And we do that. We gather those energies about us by through meditation, by really considering ourselves and looking back at ourselves, and knowing who we are, you know, and trying to take responsibility for all of our thought, word, and deed. SL?
We thought it was interesting in the second presentation about the idea of self-sacrifice. But key there is that if we want right perception, we have to practice self-sacrifice in the way outlined. We cannot have truly right perception, even on a worldly level or a spiritual level, without preceding it with some self-sacrifice. Selfishness at any degree is going to color that right perception.
We think we understand that very well, is that our personality colors everything that we do. And so we need to, you know, transcend that personality, and being mindful is how we begin to control it. You know, our thoughts, our words, our deeds, it's all a process. It all begins with our very thoughts. You know, and that we have to become the gatekeepers of our own world. So that's the mind. SL?
Yes, thanks. To follow up. So at the very beginning, we talked about the atmosphere of impersonality that we try to maintain at the meetings, the anonymity. Well, from this perspective, that's an attempt for us all to put aside our personalities, our personal inclinations, and sacrifice ourselves to a mutual goal of understanding the teachings. And by that, we are all more capable of the right perception of the philosophy. So the method there is very much in line with these paramitas that we've had expressed.
Yes, we have to divorce ourselves, detach ourselves from any sort of personal perception that can affect an idea or a person, just like it was mentioned about gossip or speaking negative about somebody. These are that person, that speaker's perception about what it is that is going on. And by clearing out and detaching ourselves from these personal perceptions, it gives us the ability in order to focus on others.
Well, the idea that love, harmony, and patience and detachment are the foundations of our physical world. You know, love is an expression that we all know what it is, but we know it by degree. And when we come to understand that there is a love that embraces all of life, that is that big, we begin to understand how our small loves for each other and things and so forth is transcended by this compassion. And then this compassion seeks harmony, which is moral justice. And that is attained by patience, by waiting, by seeking, but not pushing yourself in front or ahead. And it's sort of amazing that indifference to our pain and pleasure and gathering about us a control over our lower nature, that there is a transmutation of energy, because now we're directing it, or we can direct it into a higher, our higher nature. So, go ahead.
On page 52 and 53 of The Voice of the Silence, the virtues are listed. And if one looks at what they are, a charity and love, as was just mentioned, harmony in word and act, patience, indifference to pleasure and pain, energy, meditation, and the last one was prajna, a culmination of them all. We can see that it's important for us to try and detach from the personal attributes that we see around us all the time. And the fourth one that was mentioned in the quote that was read, virga, indifference to pleasure and to pain, illusion conquered, truth alone perceived. And it was said that this is where we can start. And this is exactly what, when we detach from the personal, it helps to clear up the perceptions. It helps us to love easier and gets rid of the illusions. So, you know, we do have work to do, but we also know that it's work that will benefit all mankind.
SL?
In the first presentation, the various stages of meditation were given out. We first select a subject, then concentrate on it, and then meditate on it. So that final stage of meditation seems to mean that our minds are thoroughly devoted to it, and there's a complete abstraction or unawareness of anything else. That's what distinguishes meditation. So the question is, how do we translate that? How do we bring that down to our everyday life? And it would seem that the only way we can do that is to select an ideal, select a virtue. Benjamin Franklin talks about this, but to select an ideal, to concentrate it so much that every other notion is an abstraction to us. So hold on throughout our day a particular virtue, whatever it is, love, honesty, devotion, friendship, whatever it is, to select an ideal, to concentrate it so that nothing else, and bring the power of that idea to everything we do that day.
And there's also that term that we hear in the philosophy is developing a life's meditation. And by doing what was just said, we can find the sacred in the mundane in everything that we do, whether it be preparing a meal, talking to someone, but to bring that meditative state into all all that we do.
And if anyone has tried to meditate, it is not the easiest thing to do. There is a mind that is fully active. They call it a monkey mind. But it's constantly chattering, and it's constantly doing things. We need to quiet that monkey mind. Meditation is how we do it, by picking an idea and then concentrating on it and then meditating on it. It's very simple, but you know, it's not easy. It's not easy because we are constantly being distracted, constantly. And the only time that our soul can touch us, or we can touch it, is when we're quiet, when we're calm. SL.
Well, Krishna reassures us that even a little of this practice delivers a human being from great risk. And it occurs to us that if we can destroy the progress of years by 1 minute of carelessness and allowing the worst of us to show through and have to start again, the opposite must be true too. If we can for a minute practice this kind of meditation, we've built a foundation from which we can build and make it even longer and better in the future.
Yes, we should not judge even our meditations. Just keep on trying.
Yes, keep on trying. That we know that HPB used to say about keep trying. If you fall off, you know, get back up. Just keep trying. Doesn't matter how many times you fail, as long as you keep trying. And it's meditation is, in this day and age, is very hard. But we also know that we have seen many reports, even personal anecdotes of the good things that have come from meditation, not just in the philosophy, but all over in many of the everyday world. People now are noticing the benefits of meditation.
Well, that's what the purpose of meditation is. It's transformational. It's to transform an ordinary person to be more calm, more concerned, more compassionate. That's a change. Not a change, but it's a exposing of what really is there. JCS?
You know, that's the word exposing, like peeling back the layers of the onion until you get to the heart of it, is really a great concept. But earlier was mentioned, you know, 30 minutes a day would be a great period of meditation. But as if we're beginners, or if we're encountering a cycle of distraction or difficulty, is it okay to break the 30 minutes into like a morning and an evening? I guess it would be best to do 30 minutes in the morning, 30 minutes in the evening, but is there a kindly starting point? No efforts lost, but where's the beginning when we seem overwhelmed?
We've also heard that even if you can only do 5 minutes at a time, that as long as that's a decent, a quality 5 minutes, that is fine. I mean, we've heard that in the philosophy as well. We think that it has to be built up.
And no, go ahead, SL.
Well, the importance of how often or how long we do it during the day is to establish a cycle, to establish an impression, a wave of energy that's going to return again and again at the same time to help us. And just like we can exercise for 5 or 10 minutes a day at the same time, or study or eat, anything we do on a regular basis establishes a cycle, a rhythm, a natural rhythm in the body. And so we as the first sentence of our class this morning was, we begin where we are. And for some of us, it may not be that amount of time. So the important thing is that we begin to make the effort.
Yes, and we begin where we are. Begin where we are. There's never an opportune moment.
We have a few more minutes left. We have more. We have a question here at Theosophy Hall.
Will this give us infinite energy of a liberated mind? Is that what it will accomplish?
The question is, will this give us infinite
energy of the liberated mind?
Infinite energy of the liberated mind.
Well, would be nice.
That would be the goal, we think. That it would give us the infinite energy of the liberated mind. And liberating it from the distractions, from that monkey mind. So, and by not focusing on all that silliness we shouldn't call it silliness, but as we try and detach ourselves from all the continuous stuff, everyday stuff that interferes with our concentration and meditation, then that will give us more of that infinite energy of the liberated mind, because then the mind hopefully will be liberated.
And it all comes down to our motive.
Yes.
All comes down to our motive. And that we are here to benefit mankind, to help and aid poor, suffering humanity. All we're asked to do is to help. Just help. Help in places that you see, rather than being a resistance against change. Because change is the only thing that's inevitable. And we all know that. So become that witness of change is what we are trying to do.
And we have a very short quote from the Voice of the Silence. It starts on 51, and it kind of finishes up everything in regards to our study of the Paramitas. Yea, Lord, I see the path, its foot in mire, its summit lost in glorious light nirvanic, and now I see the ever-narrowing portals on the hard and thorny way to jhana which is wisdom. So we want to thank everyone and have a good week. And we will see you all on Wednesday.